some of what I want to talk about. I first started thinking about when I did my Master Divinity thesis at Harvard Divinity School a few years ago. Basically, I want to first invite us to think about the situation we find ourselves in as Christians living in the 20th century, and particularly North American Christians. And I think this is a situation that is particular to us as North American, and I would add upper middle class Christians. It is not the case, and whenever we say 20th century Christian jugglers, I feel a little sheepish about that, because we're not talking about an experience that's true for all people, and right in our own cities and towns. But the situation I would name as frenetic lives. And Steve Hitchcock, who's here in the front row, is on teaching staff this week, and he's going to be doing a number of sessions in the subsequent days that are going to look more at that situation. And given his expertise with demographics and a whole host of other things, talking about work and family, time, and the third one is?
Changing nature of work.
And I commend those sessions to you as a chance to delve more into some of these things in a world and a culture that's just changing incredibly fast. So what I want to do is just kind of point to that situation and make sure we all know what we're talking about, and then go on to talk about some other things. And let me get into just talking about that situation in a few ways. When I was working on this several years ago, I was very busy. So I taped Garrison Keillor's monologues on Prairie Home Companion because I didn't have time to listen to it religiously every week as I wanted to. Well, it just so happened that I had one monologue on tape, and in that monologue, Garrison Keillor said something that I thought was very helpful, so I'll just read it to you. Kate and Chuck moved to town about 6 years ago, and Chuck got the job at the school. They were both of them school teachers, and they both applied, but the school district thought if they gave Chuck the job, well, they said to Kate, that kind of takes care of you too, doesn't it? Gave your husband a job. So she stayed home to raise the kids and be active in things. I think that gets at some of the juggling, so to speak, that we try to figure out how to live out. In this case, it was the dual career issue, and that's, I think, part of this whole sort of frenetic scenario. What I did in thinking about this and trying to get at the situation is I interviewed, I kind of used folks at Lutheran liberal arts colleges in the United States as sort of my case study. And I'll say a little bit more about that later, why I picked that. But and I interviewed some of them to kind of like, what's your life like? How's it going? And I want to read one extended bunch of comments that one of those faculty people made about their lives. When I hear people talk about how they make it, juggling all the demands in their lives, I hear them say things like, I say no to students a lot. I say, don't call me at home. I say, see me only during my office hours. I don't over-prepare for my classes. I now go in and I just teach them about the writer we're studying, and that's it. Well, I went to school at a small liberal arts school, and part of the strength of that school to me was the fact that the faculty were involved with students, and they didn't just go in and teach topic X. They were also on campus in the evenings, and they were very much involved in the school as a whole. I know they felt overworked, but it was important to them as faculty because that's part of what education is. I wonder if what I'm beginning to hear is, I have to make a decision because I have to do research, I have to do teaching, I have to do my outside life, and I can't cut back on my outside life. These are often people with children and spouses. So it comes down to a choice between research and teaching. So she goes on to say, what are we here for? Aren't we here to do more for our students than just teach X? I have to do my job very well and to do research, but I also have two young children. I also should be getting another degree, and that means commuting to the city. Also, it's important to me to be involved in the college community, serving on committees, etc. I also happen to be one of those people who needs to sleep at night. One thing that suffers is that I don't have many friends out here because I'm split in so many pieces. I like to have students over to my house for dinner. Do I have to decide I can't do that anymore for a year because I have to write a book because I'm up for tenure soon? Don't we have room at this college for 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 different kinds of people, some of whom are very good scholars and some who would like to work on a project over 5 or 10 years? Do we say we can only get tenure if you can do all those things? Is the college going to tenure superwomen who are going to collapse after a few years, or superwomen who are so burned out that even after sabbatical, they just aren't doing some of the things they had been doing, like extracurricular activities, or they're frustrated because they didn't get that book finished during sabbatical and now they don't have any time for all their other responsibilities? I think that kind of gives you a glimpse into one kind of life, and I think more and more we're realizing that that's just not one person's life. And if we look around in magazines, we see more and more articles about that very thing. And one of the ones I cited in this article was a recent article titled Acceleration Syndrome that was in the Utney Reader that was about just the pace of life going faster and faster, but also about how people, as a way of coping with that, are developing the ability to do several things at one time. And it shared in the article incredible stories about the guy who comes home and that's his time to read the paper, listen to the TV news, and talk to his wife. And that's the time he has set aside to do all three of those, but he has to do them simultaneously. We also see books coming out that are trying to address the issue for us. One is titled, I should get the full citation, Enough is Enough, Exploring the Myth of Having It All. And it's also known as the Official Handbook of Superwomen's Anonymous. Another one is titled Sequencing, Having It All But Not All at Once, A New Solution for Women Who Want Marriage, Career, and Family. What I think is very interesting about some of those helps to us, some of those solutions to our dilemma, is what? What strikes you about those last two? Yeah. It's women's problem. You know, nobody's telling men they can't do it all. Nobody's telling men that, well, maybe you have to do one thing at a time. Now, one could maybe cynically respond that, well, we never expected men to do it all in the first place. So the dilemma isn't really how are they going to juggle all these things, because we've never asked them to juggle all those things. So when I started on this topic, it was couched in terms of women's changing roles. The dilemma, I think, for some is increased because things have changed for women. I mean, a basic economic change has happened in our culture. And that we haven't kept pace with that revolution. So now just women are doing it all instead of working in the home only. We're liberated. We can work out of the home now, too. So I think that's a backdrop, at least for me, as I think about why are our lives more frenetic. I think that's one of the things we have to acknowledge, along with all the things Steve will talk about cultural, technological changes, too. Before we go on beyond understanding the situation, do you have comments you want to add about, I mean, do you think we're onto something here to say that something's rotten in Denmark, as Shakespeare said? I mean, there's something not right here. Our lives are crazy and wild. Is that your experience for yourselves or of others? And is this a significantly different situation than it was years ago? Let's talk just for a few minutes about the situation. Yeah.
I've been interested this summer as a teacher. I lived that kind of life during the year, and then during the summer, I'm having a hard time adjusting to all the freedom I have. And I've had to say, wait a minute, it's all right to read the book, it's all right to relax. I have to keep telling myself that over and over. It takes me a month to feel that I'm okay being this comfortable and lazy.
Sorry, you feel guilty, isn't it? I'm a teacher too, I just want to help you out.
Yeah.
I just take some time, I look at the world, step back.
I find that planning for a couple of classes.
To wind down, doesn't it?
But that makes me wonder if there's something wrong, you know, that, because I allow myself to get in that.
I think we shouldn't feel guilty. I'm a nurse. And, I mean, a retired nurse. But you have that same feeling. I think from us, those of us who are older, your culture was something you didn't waste time. You know, everything was important. So that even after lunch, you know, I have a hard time stopping. Even now, when I'm over 70, I think I'm guilty. I'm wasting time. I shouldn't even stop and read the paper. I should do something else.
But there's a little piece of that, I guess I have to agree with Andrew a little bit, that feels like blaming the victim. That if things have changed, and what I'm going to suggest is that there's some structural issues here too, that to just say to people, well, if you just say no to all these things, you know, your life will be fine. As before we just move on from the situation, I have kind of a new insight about all this as of a week and a half ago when the gospel text from Luke was the Mary and Martha story. And I happened to preach on it here. Yeah, maybe it was an interesting sermon. You know, there was some music in the background and, oh, you know, I had some neat illustrations. But, I mean, I didn't think that the sermon merited the amazing amount of feedback I got. Just people loved it. Oh, they felt spoke to. Well, and now what I was talking about was I think we all are Martha distracted with many things. And people just responded more strongly than I have experienced here ever before. And that is a new piece to me, then an additional piece to saying that, yeah, there's something going on that's very real, very existential for people. Well, given the situation then, I want to pull in another piece to our discussion. And that is Martin Luther's understanding of vocation. And vocation as understood not as we commonly use the term as our job in the marketplace, but his understanding of vocatio, or calling. That is, well, maybe I'll give a... He was responding to the medieval church's view of vocation that only churchly kinds of occupations were true callings. And he wanted to redefine that to be the general call of a Christian. And he defined vocation to refer to all our callings, the whole theater of personal, communal, and historical relationships in which we live. So he understood all our tasks, responsibilities, and opportunities as callings. So we are friend, parent, daughter, student, teacher, potter, whatever we're doing, that all of those are callings of ours. All of those are ways in which we love the neighbor. And that would be his basic understanding of the calling of a Christian, to love their neighbor. So that's just like a brief but very basic understanding, I think, that we can all understand. And it means that then not just our job in the workplace is important, but all those other roles we find ourselves in are equally important. Or as Luther would understand them, there are all ways in which we get the neighbor loved. And I think that's an incredibly important criteria for sorting out our roles and our callings. To look at them and say, are we getting the neighbor loved well in each of these or in any of them? We're sitting doing this juggling. Well, are we loving the neighbor well in any of them, then, we could ask. That the story about the quote from the faculty member who said, well, I don't have time for friends. Okay, that's one whole calling falling out of the picture. But we could also ask, was she feeling like she was doing her other callings very well? Was she loving her kids well? Was she loving her spouse well? Was she loving her students well? Any of those other things. And I think that's an important criteria for us to bring to evaluating where we're at. Vingren, a modern interpreter of some of Luther's understanding, says, "With a clear eye, love also sees immediately when, for the neighbor's sake, old practices must give way to something new. The task of the church includes a continuing renewal of the worldly orders, a never-ending alertness in all vocations, from the princely to the meanest labor." And I think, as Christians, and as many of us, perhaps Lutheran, with these very clear Lutheran underpinnings for how we can sort things out, I think we have reason to do some reevaluating. Apart from the fact that many people are in great pain, life is not good. Apart from that, just bringing in that very clear criteria from Luther of, is the neighbor getting loved well? So then we could, so we're whizzing past then some of these theological underpinnings and saying, well, so then what can we do about that? One thing we can do is just to come up with better solutions. We can say no more. We can come up with creative ways to do that juggling. And what I find right now is that's where most people are at. We say to each other, how are you guys doing it over there in Northfield? How are you balancing your two careers and all your other involvements? And you tell some stories about, well, we've caught on to this. We've got this great day timer, or we've got this phone answering machine, and, you know, we've got these other things. And really, it's helping our life, and we're able to do the juggling pretty well. And then you say, well, how are you doing it? Oh, I tell you about, you know, well, I break speed limits, and I do this and that, and I manage to get everything into my life. That's how I do it. And we basically share these idiosyncratic solutions that are helpful to us, but not necessarily too helpful to you. So I think another way we can address the question of, so what do we do, is to move some of these very, for us, private dilemmas. You know, gosh, I'm just mired in what my life is like. Move these private dilemmas to the level of public issues, or that would be one way to say it. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean public as in political, necessarily our traditional understanding of political, but to make them shared issues at the point where there's some points of intersection between our crazy stories. You know, here we're kind of all sitting around reinventing the wheel, maybe, and what could maybe be done at a larger level that helps us live out our many callings. And I keep coming back to that, the callings business, because I think as Lutherans and as Christians, I'm working out of a Lutheran understanding, but it's very, very similar to, I think, most Christian understandings. I think we all have this understanding of loving the neighbor in our many roles. That I think we have good reason to lead the way in making these issues more shared and public issues at the level of policies. Why do we as Christians sit around waiting for corporations to come up with new and innovative policies? Oh, corporations discover job sharing. Or, oh, God, they're coming up with on-site daycare. God, maybe we'll try that in our church organizations. So that is why, for my sort of case study, I looked at a place where we were Lutherans together. I could have maybe gone to the Lutheran headquarters or something, but I looked at Lutheran church colleges as a place where we have philosophically and theologically some common underpinnings, and we say we are a church organization. So then how are we living that out in those organizations, in those institutions? How are we saying we want to help people live out their many callings and do that in a shared kind of way? So I got on the phone and called academic deans around the country, and I asked them, so what are you doing about this, this, and this? Have you come up with some new creative ways to... And I was specifically addressing dual career couples who are on staff, on faculty. I realize it's a very small slice of the picture. And also, what are you doing to get folks to your institution? And I thought Lutheran colleges were a great place to look at this issue, because often they're located in small towns in the middle of nowhere. So some of the issues, I think, are heightened for them, because you get maybe, professor to come to Timbuktu. Well, what's their spouse going to do? What if their spouse is a professional? How are you helping people live out their many roles when the place might not, we go back to Garrison Keillor's story. We got him a job. He's directing the orchestra. His wife can, she can look for something. And so I asked them about specific policies. Now, those are policies particular to Lutheran colleges. And I think, we could talk about those, and we could talk about other policies that, and I'm calling them policies, but things that affect more than one person, that make it possible for people to live in more creative, humane ways. Some of the things we looked at with colleges were part-time teaching being tenure eligible. In the broader way from colleges, then we could say part-time work being career viable. I think that's something, now parenthetically jump ahead. We talk about these policies, but then the question is, what can we do about it? So at the same time as we talk about this, I want to be asking, what can we as church people be doing to work for these changes? Do we sit around and wait for somebody else to make it happen? Or should we be advocating for some of these changes in very concrete ways? How do we model, how do we be, and borrowing the phrase of a woman named Sharon Parks, a mentoring community of imagination for the wider society? A community of imagination that says, this is a new way we can do things. So part-time work being career viable, I think, is one important thing. And we see variations of that all around, job sharing. And when I was looking at colleges, there are a few colleges that have allowed two different faculty members to pair up and share one job. In most cases, they've been spouses. Also, the issue of, and very few have on the books, that part-time teaching is tenure eligible. Tenure being that thing that the institution says to you, we want to keep you, and it's a matter of job security in the academic world. On-site daycare, a battle that several colleges are fighting. Faculty who say, it would really help my life a lot if, why don't we get together and have daycare right here on site? Corporations are doing it. Interesting that many colleges are finding that their excuse as judged by faculty members, is that, well, there's the liability issue, but then how is it that corporations have addressed that issue and we kind of get stuck in the church? Clusters of cooperating institutions. For example, in Pennsylvania, there's a Lutheran college that's near some other institutions in an urban area. Well, they've done some cooperating with those other institutions and industries in the area so that they're communicating with each other when, say, a couple wants to move there, and helping them find suitable jobs for both of them. We might also just want to give more priority to the impact of how some jobs are set up and the impact that has on families and individuals. Back in 1980, the White House Conference on Families called for more family-oriented personnel policies. And Mondale suggested that there be a family impact statement that would come out relative to certain kinds of jobs. I would suggest we could maybe call it a multiple callings impact statement. How does this job, how does this situation impact my ability to live out my many callings? Tell me what you're thinking. I've just thrown out a bunch of, I'm sure you've heard of more of these sort of policies and innovations that, I mean, are there some of these things that you've longed for, like, God, I wish such and such would happen, or things you've thought of, things you've wished for? And then what are some ways that we could help be advocates for those changes? And I think that the role of being advocates and figuring out ways to work for that is a very appropriate arena for us as Christians, just as we say it's appropriate for us to advocate for world hunger kinds of concerns, legislation that's going to affect equal distribution of food, and all the other arenas in which we find ourselves.
To know what is the impact of this type of work on family, on multiple vocational, but I don't know what you said.
Family impacts.
Yeah,
analysis,
vocational impact analysis, that would even rise to the level that we as a group would think that that's of value. I mean, I don't know that we're there. We're frustrated, yeah, a lot of people are, but I think we're still at the stage of wanting to put band-aids on things rather than maybe make some fundamental changes that maybe band-aids aren't going to work. I mean, maybe we can't do all these things well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess we could work on various, you know, daycare or part-time jobs as single issues, but I think it's also very important to try to encourage people to think that the quality of life and it is a value that's getting lost to money.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, like me, think that the full-time professional work week is fundamentally flawed. I just think it even for a single person, I just think it doesn't allow for all those roles, all those callings. Well, what would that mean? You know, we think, well, I can't do much about that. I don't understand economic systems and you know, how do you impact that? Where do you even begin? But those are the kinds of things that trap people. Well, you can tell people to just say no, but they can't say no to working full time. Their employer doesn't allow it. You know, of course, we could then talk more about downward adjustment, downscaling our lifestyle and our needs. But how many families would love to share childcare and many other responsibilities, but they can't because they both can't work part time. They'd be happy to live on that income, but their employers, their institutions don't make that an option.
But see, if you look at that in light of academia, which is where you've been putting most of your focus, academic institutions are always working in search of excellence, and they want that faculty member that's going to go the extra mile, that's going to coach this and that and make the athletics and help the students become well-rounded. Also at colleges, they want the faculty that's going to attend recitals and do these extra things. And in fact, a friend of ours who is on a search committee at a Lutheran college was saying that when they were in the hiring process, a big emphasis was on, let's, we've got to get that person that's going to go the extra mile and give their all to this institution. And this guy on that search committee was the only one who spoke up and said, hey, wait a minute. That person then, the more people we hire like that, the more is expected out of everyone they set the standards to. And we have to try to get away from hiring that kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And to take the person who can speak up like that in front of their boss and their department chair and say, we have to hire someone.
Well, Tom, can you think about that in terms of like, if you're hiring, then that is part of the job description, and time needs to be allowed for it. So what you're saying is, let's get realistic, we really want people who will give time like this, but it shouldn't be time that's also stolen away from family. They need to have less classes to teach, or you know, some other thing, let it be part of the job description instead of sort of saying whether they're going to history to that.
Yeah.
Well, there's something wrong in the country, because then you use that phrase in every aspect. You're talking about education and that, but you could talk about nursing.
Oh, yeah. That's just a case study.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But I mean, you know, you could talk about every aspect. And they're trying to drag everybody down the drain, you know, by just push, push, push.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But who do we all admire? The one who goes the extra mile.
That's
who do we set up and write about and talk about and crazy?
That's the one who gets tired, the one who gets engaged and says, yep, they did everything for us.
Well, the opposite is a search for mediocrity.
Exactly.
And that certainly is the direction the country.
Well, no, I think you just confused two terms there, quantity and quality. How did not putting in more time, I mean, I'm hearing going the extra mile is mostly a quantity issue. Yeah, it's a commitment issue, but it's
well,
quantity.
Certainly, if he attends recitals every night of the week, then it takes him twice as long as him correcting his paper because he just can't do it.
Sure. And how did that become mediocrity? If you do what you do well, but you just don't do as much of it.
Well, the whole thing that I hear you saying, I hear her saying, is we want to be sure that we start toning down, cutting back on preparation for classes, time allowed for students. Now, you may find, yes, that's true. You may say, okay, somebody can simply put it and not produce the results. But you aren't going to produce the results without putting in the time. And I guess I don't know, my feeling is I've been in the teaching business for quite a while, and I've seen a lot of people that have stayed in there for a long time, and they've never gone an extra mile. They've never even gone an extra step. And who is supporting them when they come to the bargaining table and want more money? Those of us who have, you know, put my record up, those of us who have gone that extra mile over and over again. And it isn't just a question of lobbying. I think that may be a little bit of a looper in some cases. I don't want to do it. It's taking this away from me.
Getting some disagreement. You want to?
Yeah, I really don't agree with that. I think even some people, given the extra time, aren't necessarily going to take care of their children. It is used as an excuse, and I think there are no studies showing that the workaholic does not necessarily produce anything. They're there all day and all night, but they don't necessarily do anything. They go and lock themselves behind the door, and everyone says, that guy was here first thing in the morning, the last thing in the night, but what is he doing? Well, if they were released somehow, they're still around and setting standards for everyone else, and everyone else is living up to this individual who really hasn't produced much at all.
Mm. So you're bringing a point to me. I was an auditor in World War II, and I was with a campaign that was about Carrie Wooler. She was on a tennis court, and I was on a board of amputations, and she used to say, hey, Bake, my name is Bake. Just because you're tearing around all the time doesn't mean that you're doing any more than I do. And I think you got the point. I think I thought I was doing it, but this was very interesting.
Steve?
The other part of your title that intrigued me is the fragility, that some of our sense of freneticness is not always just because of the quantity of activity, but the anxiety that produces that activity. And to use the academic model again, I think part of why search committees have this problem is that the sense of community and the sense of knowing one's colleagues has declined. And so we make judgments about people based upon their ability to produce rather than their ability to know each other and to know that person's work in a more holistic fashion. The model I thought of when you said, are there solutions, is that when we were younger, we belonged to a babysitting cooperative. Two things happened. One is that we were able to get babysitting without the economic impact, but there was also that sense of security that came from knowing there was a network of parents. And I wonder if it isn't possible for the church to provide some leadership in expanding that sense of cooperativeness. What if parishes form economic cooperatives? One of the things that I spend a great deal of my time, and Jan does too, is paying all of the premium bills that a modern American family has. I mean, it's a dream, but maybe there needs to be a large cash management fund that somehow manages the finances for families in a parish so that we're all sort of individually reinventing the wheel of trying to manage the family finances. Maybe there are other ways that cooperativeness can be enhanced so that the fragility issue or the sense of fragility can be lessened.
Mm-hmm. Just a step further,
cooperative, and there were a lot of them back in the early 70s.
And those things that are useful, really, we really need them, not all material.
But every time they raise the price, we pay. So, and we complain, we go home and we complain, but we have a toothache, we go and we pay.
Well, in defense of dentists, they can do it for $5.
Not just dentists, but everything has become so big, just the small needs of people can't be met without this frantic, frenetic race towards getting all that you can have it, which should be just basic amenities human beings to be guaranteed as a right, as a birthright. And that sounds really idyllic, but I think we could easily meet everyone's needs because things don't have to cost that much.
We're spending a smaller percentage of our income on necessities these days than we did 50 years ago.
We're very lucky.
Yes, but it isn't the necessities that are doing us.
They
don't cost much. No, that's why those basic things could easily be taken care of by the society at large if we restructured those systems. And then people who want to be, excessively materialistic and get these big boats and big whatever things they have to have can have it, but at least people who don't have wouldn't have to spend on an insurance policy that they probably never would use anyway. And have the fear of if anything happens, they not be taken care of medically or whatever. It could provide those basic things without killing somebody, actually making a dollar in need with nothing. Those who are the have not. There's got to be a way to provide the basic things for everyone without everyone having to, high level here and real low level here.
The question is, who cares enough to make that change? People are very proud to say how much they spent for necessities. I went into the hospital for my dealing with a headache. $20,000 baby, and it required this and that. And yet, people in New York told me about how much money they spend. Even though on one hand they don't have enough money for that, but they like talking about how much status. But I, for me, I wonder who cares enough to make changes. Because if you want change, I would think if all of the churches, Christians, talking all denominations, to make a change, I would think there's enough individuals. If the churches can't come together, they're kind of expected to come together. So I guess I'm cynic, because the Christians should be the ones who make a change. If I want a change in my community, I want the church. I want that change to come from the church, because if the politicians get it to me, then they can take it away from me. of the church, the people that care differently because they care about my basic needs. And they're helping me to build on something, and so it's not something that they take back from me. You have a different understanding of things that you receive through the church. But we can't, I don't see the churches coming together. I don't see Christians coming together. The town where I live at, and there's so many churches, and there's poverty, there's everything there. But one minister is afraid that if someone, members of his church goes to another church and says, you know, someone is going to steal his flock. You know, they won't invite other ministers in. Various speakers, there's reasons not to bring in female ministers, or this particular minister who may be kind of handsome. They come up with their own little personal reasons. So for me, if the churches can't come together, then we're really, I wonder just where, who are the people that really feel we're really going to come from? You know, where does change begin? Yeah. And if everyone just goes home and takes care of their own individual family, I think that's a great start. But a lot of people, and this is perhaps unfair to say, well, I'm going to say a lot of people, the ones that seem to say the most are the ones that don't necessarily take care of the home front. You know, they might be doing things on a, let's take a minister who's doing much for the congregation, but what about his children? What about his wife? His children, his family, and they receive nothing from him, but yet he has a lot to give to the congregation. And to me, if every individual person would have to just take care of their own personal family, then all of our worldly problems could be solved. But we want to go out and take care of the mass of people, and then that little group at home, that's very important.
There's no turning back to that. Well, that's where we came from. That's where we came from. We're just not going there because the population is burgeoning. We can't meet our needs and our families anymore. Yeah, well, I mean, you get back to pre-industrial when people lived in their family, with their family, quite rural, and farmed the land and raised and had their country school maybe if they were lucky. You know, back in that time, which wasn't very long ago. And we're sort of in a transition crisis because our population has stepped up. We become more socially aware. We live in big cities. We just don't live like that anymore. And that's our crisis, because we've been raised by our grandparents and partly the tail end of our parents' generation in that sort of a lifestyle with those sort of values, and we're so fit with where we're heading for us to develop.
But we created all that's here. You know, our parents gave us a set of values, but yet we weren't able to instill those same values in our children. I think there's something wrong with that. I was raised with a certain set of values. I believe those same values I was able to instill in my children, even living in today's society. Because I raised my children in my home. They don't just go visit the neighbors. When they come home from school, they know you come home from school, you have your responsibilities, and so you fill their day up with chores and works and different things, so then they don't have all that time to say, what you want to do? What else can I do? And then they go and find some kind of, they're in search of something.
Comment, Victor?
Well, one of the things that
happened
to me is that when I was young, I spent 2 years in India, a few years ago. And when I came back, it was a long enough time to be gone, and then I really kind of got into the lifestyle of not having things. Because you just don't have things there. There's a lot of depth to the culture that's not all hanging on what you can buy next. And when I came back, it was such a shock. People didn't seem to want to be concerned or talk about anything very important except what they had just bought or what they didn't get next. It really struck me. Mm. And I think in our culture, if we're going to be able to get basic needs met, some of our work in our own congregations and our own communities together could be toward this thing about what are our basic needs. And I think a lot of people almost fear not having this goal of what am I going to buy next, because
if you didn't have that, there would be a vacuum. Like, there was, what else is there to do? Except that I'm going up, and the way it shows is that I'm getting something bigger and better all the time. Maybe what we really need to do is work on our set of what you do with your life if you're not going for all that stuff.
I spent 9 years in Africa, and I mean, twice, once per year, and a couple other times, 3 months, 1 month. And I was just shocked. I ran away from all this material. And when I came back, I'm still fighting. It was about 2 years. I'm still fighting. I drive down the street in my hometown, which was about 30,000 when I left, and it's about 45,000 now. And it's like, there's more and more and more of, you know, parties and all these food places, and it's just more bigger mall. The mall's about 15 times bigger than it was, and it's just, what? All that stuff, and people are all complaining on. We just got stuff, and some people can't even walk through their basements because they got all this stuff they've been saving. And, yeah. You lose so much of life when you're just caught up in pursuit of stuff.
But I really think that vacuum is a big fear.
So in some ways it's really a spiritual issue.
Yeah, there's a reason that that's happening. And what causes people to do that?
It's avoiding the real issue. It's a mistake.
And you can't be happiness with
it. Partly. It satisfies you. Instant gratification instead of feeling like a real need and looking at them as a need and value.
And somehow the church's response to that, or its alternative offer, hasn't been perceived to be very winsome or very valuable. I mean,
everybody in the church seems to be caught in pursuing the same.
The trouble is the church over the most of its history has been trained not to act but to react. So that the onward Christian soldiers are often marching off and exhausted, everybody else miles ahead of them.
Comment from Wilmer over here. Put a hand up.
Well, I think the solution would be, you're all talking about all these problems. Why don't each one of us go to one of those countries that don't have anything and stay there for about 2 months and come back and the problems are solved.
Not solved, but we become a lot less oriented in the direction that we're speeding towards. It seems to me like a big material garbage heap.
That basically you're saying we need some kind of change in ourselves, and you're saying the fastest way to do that would be to go to one of these other cultures.
I said it all the time, and all of you have said that everybody, every American can just come over here for a visit.
Can they
get out of America a little bit and broaden their viewpoint about to see how people use the garbage. They rehammer old metal cars and make their kitchen utensils, their stoves, their spoons, their ladles. I mean, they use, if we could just send over one junkyard, a village in Africa would have enough abundance for 50 years, you know.
Go out and make a house with nothing.
I made a house out of the dirt.
It's an unrealistic solution because you have people that don't want to, don't care to, and it would never even cross their mind, and they would
really
say,
it would change me, and I can't buy into the American system.
But to change the American system, to come
just
up
to
with a realistic solution.
Or to find places within the system that can be more humane. I mean, I think that's what we're talking about when we talk about the workplace and other things.
We're joining class this morning. Most of us are immigrants or second generation from the Germans and the Scandinavians, and as well as a lot of the others who came here. And the work ethic was so important, and success was so tied up with money. We're going to be lots of years before we know that. I was raised by an Irishman who cares nothing about money to this day, and who never cared about money. And so I always have a different perspective on life. And I see a bumper sticker or those things that say happiness is shopping at Nordstrom's, and I just want a car. that's all over. Happiness in the Northwest is shopping at Nordstrom's. And 3/4 of the women you meet have that same philosophy. And I think, how can I even relate to you, woman, that you have to do it? This is the whole and also shame, so this is another part of codependency. It's a sickness that's in our land.
And I think that's partly to do, I mean, to get back to your part-time work in the office. I mean, I don't agree with that.
No. I did not say part-time work in the office.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
If I implied that, that was a mistake.
Okay.
What I said was that the implication of the person on the committee saying that we must not hire these people who are willing to go the extra mile. We have to avoid hiring those who may be, in most cases, excellent. The best candidates is the No, I'm all in favor of the idea of sharing, even though my daughter at Concordia had a very unhappy experience with them, shared professorship. And inevitably, one is going to be better than the other, it's going to be something happening. If they're sharing exactly the same job, same classes, I think there's some problems there. But as far as the idea, that's...
But I guess it's my concern that the work ethic that says if you're really good and you're really going to try to succeed in your career, you're going to want to do it 14 hours a day, and if you don't want to do it 14 hours a day, then you're really not very motivated, so you're probably not going to get very good. I mean, I work for the Attorney General's Office in Washington, and that's more the philosophy of the society of Attorney General right now. Work sharing is not acceptable. I mean, all you have to do is cut the caseload in half, and you could do just as good a job on the cases that you've got. In fact, maybe a better job, because you wouldn't be so overwhelmed. You know, you have a little refreshment at home.
Part of the problem with part-time jobs is that you end up working...
Well, you do. You end up working more. I was a part-time teacher for a while, and you end up working two-thirds. Yeah.
So the smart employers hire a lot of part-time. They don't have to do benefits, they get a lot more work on it.
Yeah, depending on, but those aren't career positions. I mean, it's kind of a thing. If you're really a professional and you're really serious, you're going to want to, and that's, I think, the whole work ethic that a lot of us are based on.
That was shocking for me to come back and find out that they'll let me work 7 3/4 hours just to cut you off from the benefits. That trend becoming so big, it's like getting cut off more and more and more from the basic thing everyone should be entitled to. And it's just a burn. You know, it just makes me cringe to see these things going on and on and getting worse and worse. It doesn't seem to be getting better.
And that's not why? Just corporations,
no.
That's even school districts.
Right.
Sure. Whatever.
And why? Because it saves money. Taxpayers don't want to pay money because they're not in my vote. They're valuing other things.
Well, look at the hospitals, the shortage of nurses. They come from Minnesota. They cut out all the nurses. Now they're in dire need. And it isn't even safe to be a patient, because if you don't have your relative around you to find out what's going on, you don't know what's going to happen. That's the truth.
Well, I'm aware that the dinner bell either will ring any minute or, and we know we need to eat a lot every day.
Are we supposed to be
But,
we have to give up the meal, so.
Been really important and great and insightful. I would invite you to share more of that with the wider community tonight at the forum. Pardon?
Come to the forum.
Yeah. 9:00. And to keep talking and thinking about these things. I think these really are issues that parishes should take seriously. I think in many cases, this is a lot of what ministry to people in urban and suburban places means, because this is a lot of the stuff of their and our lives. I'm not sure that we have really sunk our teeth into these issues in terms of just at the parish level alone, let alone what does it mean when we as a community of faith in that place then link up with some broader networks of people and the church and to try to impact some of these issues. And I guess for me that is where the discussion has to take us, is to action on some of those wider levels. Yes, it can be part of our own downscaling, our own change of lifestyle, our own change of heart and vision and way of seeing, but it also, I think, has to be not only how we live, but then how are we going to make this a matter of our shared dilemmas, our shared experiences as people in this culture at this time and as Christians in the midst of that. So thanks.